two.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is All About Wine, the talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Ron.
All right. Thank you. Everybody's all excited and up and ready for a Sunday early afternoon episode, a special episode of All About Wine.
Yes, it is.
And we have, as soon as he calls in.
Yeah.
We'll have our guest, Mark Millen, I guess it's pronounced Millen, will be on. And actually, we're trying something new. We're going to be going through WhatsApp since he is in England, United Kingdom. And we're going through WhatsApp. And so hopefully there's no issues with that.
Yeah, crossing our fingers.
Yes. Crossing our fingers. Yeah. So.
But hey, Blog Talk Radio is working, so that's a good thing.
Yes. That's a plus right there. We've been having issues with Blog Talk Radio for the past month, so maybe we should change our time to 1 o'clock Sundays instead of at 7 Thursdays or something. While I think of it, too, we're probably going to rebroadcast this episode this Thursday. So if you're listening to us now, then you can hear it again this Thursday. Or, and this is a good opportunity to promote Flightline Radio. You can also listen to it on Flightline Radio next Saturday. Wow, we got almost a whole week there. Before it's on Flightline. But speaking of Flightline Radio, Mike's show program, Flightline Radio, every day, all day long. You can stream it. You can listen to him live. When are you live now? When did you finally settle in being live?
I'm on Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., right before All About Wine, the encore. Saturdays, Eastern time. So, and then
so that's,
following
that's,
the show. Yeah, it's all about wine. The honor.
That's your slot. Well, I was just wondering. I didn't know if you'd bounced
it. It changed
something
else. Times, but no, I can sleep in on Saturdays now.
There you go. All right. Well, I knew there was a method. Yeah. And also, you still got your 80s guy on Saturday evenings, don't you?
Yes. Yep. 8 to 10 p.m. That's all about the 80s with Rob Charles. He comes on, and that's a live show. He's on like 78 stations, so he's out
is
there.
Is he? Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's well known. Done quite a few of those, so he's been around. And we still have Phil and Cap, or Cap and Phil. I don't know which they prefer, but that's 1st and 15th. It's also on after All About Wine, the Encore, on Saturdays. And they're also on 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. on Wednesdays. So if you want to listen to their podcast, their talk show deal, tune in then as well. Or, you know, they're on Apple. And
they're on a bunch
of that. I'm not sure if you got the message or the email, but I also posted it on the All About Wine Facebook page. We're now on Spotify. I remember you mentioned last week someone asked you about, you know, they couldn't find us on Spotify. And I go, yeah, there's a reason. I didn't have it added to Spotify. I didn't realize it was that easy. And now we have, I believe it's 300 episodes on Spotify.
Oh,
and,
wow.
As soon as the show is done, give it a little bit, and it'll be, this one will be on Spotify as well. So if you have that, search for podcast All About Wine. The category, I guess, would be podcast, and then just do a search for All About Wine, and you'll see the same heading or logo, Ron's picture, and the All About Wine image there. So click on that and follow us, and that's a big plus. So
there's
another way to to our archives. They're all almost on there, almost all.
Oh, so, wow. Okay, good. So, well, I wrote.
We had
asked his wife to find us on Spotify. So I mentioned it last week, and Mike went in and got us on there. In fact, I emailed him and told him, you know, he can click on Spotify and find us now. So,
yeah, very cool.
But good.
Let's put the link on there, and we're still holding for Mark to join us.
Yeah.
It is a
5-hour difference between here and the United Kingdom, isn't it?
I have to go to my, let me hit the board here. I think it is.
I think it is too.
London time is 6:06 p.m. in London.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, he was told to come on at 6:00 his time. In fact,
wait a minute, we have somebody there might be on the switchboard. He didn't go through WhatsApp. We'll need to find out about that.
I know.
That's cool. +44 is the UK for sure. So yeah.
Is it?
We have somebody.
Let me see if it is Mark. I'll bring him on the show.
Oh, just hung up.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Just when I picked on him to bring him on the show, he disappeared.
Okay. Well, let's see.
He's probably sitting there trying to get through to us and having an issue.
Hmm. Yeah. Let's see where is it possible he sent you an email or anything? You want to check that out?
Let me go back and look and see. No.
Yep.
He hasn't hasn't sent any. Let's see. Let me click here. Let me look here. Let me look here. No.
So I want to make sure he's not having a problem with the link.
Last email I got from him was 4:05 a.m. our time. So that's add 6 hours to that. Was at 10 o'clock. It says Sunday at 6 British summertime. British summertime. I like that. That's better than daylight saving time. They call it British summertime. Thanks, Ron. I look forward to it. That's the last email I got from him. So.
Okay.
And then I got Pia is his publicist, and she also sent a confirmation too. And so, yeah, they know, they look forward to it, but this almost looks like he's having a problem getting in.
Anything here?
Why Block Talk Radio would kick it off like that?
Okay, let me try something else here.
Let me see.
I was checking to see if there's any storms or anything. It shows precipitation, rain today. 59 degrees. That's in London, England.
Ooh.
72% humidity. Oh, that's not good.
No.
What was this, Florida? 59 degrees. It's cold.
It is. Wow.
And precipitation today and tomorrow is a chance of precipitation. Trying to see if that might have been, if there were storms or anything, that could always.
That could always kick stuff out, yeah. But not cold. I don't have Mark's phone number either. Sometimes he'll send it to me, and I'm looking to see if maybe I have his phone number to confirm that that was him that called in and we lost. Let's see.
Hey, I don't have any calls on WhatsApp. Make sure I'm on here.
Oh, here. I just got one from him.
Okay.
He says, trying to connect, but links and numbers not working. I'm here. There's his phone number. Can we call him?
Let me see. Let me see if I can put that number. He's on the line, though. Let's see if we can bring him in.
Okay.
Are you there, Mark?
Can you hear?
I can hear you.
You can hear me.
Okay. Yes, we can. Yeah, we can hear you for sure.
Okay, it's showing me muted still. But I've been clicking on this WhatsApp link that you sent, and that's just not working.
I could, if that's the number you're calling from, I can feed that into WhatsApp and see if it connects, or do you have a, is there, well, I don't want to do that on the air because you're on the air now, or that number.
I've got WhatsApp on my phone and my computer, so looking forward to our chat, Ron. Sorry about this.
Well, we're connected now. Is there an issue anywhere with anything, Mike or Mark? Is there issues any place? I mean, we're talking, we're connected. We can go ahead and.
I'm happy to talk on my phone like this.
Okay.
Okay.
Then, welcome to All About Wine.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it is
I'm
our pleasure.
I'm looking forward to chatting. I love your show.
Oh, thank you. And speaking of love, I loved your book. I got a preliminary copy sent to me, and I've been reading it. It's fascinating. Before we get into your book,
thank you, Ron.
Tell me about you. How did you get involved with wine? What is your history up to this point?
Oh, it's a long history, Ron.
We've got time. It's
I was
Sunday afternoon.
Born in Mexico. I'll start at the beginning. I was born in Mexico. I was raised in the West Coast and the Midwest. And when I was 19 years old, I came over to England. I was only going to be here for 1 year, but I met a beautiful young 19-year-old who became my. Eventually, we got married, and that was more than 45 years ago.
Okay.
And my wife Kim is a photographer, and we began researching and writing about wine more than 40 years ago. Our first book, The Wine and Food of Europe, came out in 1982. So we've been doing this sort of thing for a long time. We've been traveling around wine country and drinking a lot of wine and learning about wine. So it's been my whole life.
Wow. First question, Midwest United States?
Yes, that's right. I went to, as I say, I was raised in California, but we moved to Ohio when I was 11 years old. I went to high school in Ohio, and I went to college in Ohio. I went to a small liberal arts college called Kenyon College.
Okay. And then deserted the Midwest for England.
Well, my mother by then moved to the East Coast, and I came over to England just for my junior year abroad, never imagining that I would still be here. More than 45 years ago, later.
Yeah, it's amazing what a cute young girl can make us do, stay in places we never thought we would.
Well, that's right, the power of love.
Yes, exactly. And you, well, you've been involved with wine your whole life. Are you, you've got all sorts of certifications because of it?
Well, I mean, I've written 15 books about wine and food and travel. And the certification I'm proudest of is I am a certified Italian wine ambassador, which is there are about 380 of us, I think, worldwide now. It's a qualification done through Vinitaly International. So it's linked to Vinitaly, this very important gathering of the Italian wine world in Verona every year. And yes, I am an Italian wine ambassador.
Do you speak Italian?
I do speak Italian.
Ah, and any other languages besides?
Well, I speak a little bit of Spanish. I wrote a book about Spanish wines, and I speak a little bit of French. My father was actually French. So we've written a number of books about France and French wines as well. But I'd have to say my real love is Italian wine.
Is it? Yeah. So the latest book, wow, 16 books. It's just, it's hard to pinpoint any particular one.
15.
Okay, that's including this one, the Italy in a Wine Glass.
I've lost you, I think.
Can you hear me now?
I lost you. I'm just faintly now. Can you hear me, Ron?
I can hear you very clearly, yes.
Okay.
You're having problems
that's
with me
better.
Still?
No, that's better. That's absolutely fine now.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
Good. So 15 books, including Italy and the Wine Glass?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And these books have covered, it sounds like, the gamut of wine-growing regions in the world. Uh-oh.
I'm sorry, I'm losing you again, Ron. Yeah, actually, I've got you back. It's
okay.
Coming and going.
Oh, boy.
Sorry to be so disruptive on your show.
We've had issues before. This is nothing new to us. We can stumble through it. So your 15 books, you've covered just about every wine-growing region in the world, it seems.
No, not at all. Not at all. No, I've been entirely European-based.
Oh.
There's a huge amount. There's a world of wine that I know nothing about. I don't really drink wines from the New World, as we call it, although it's not so new anymore. My focus has been on European wines because I've always what interests me most, Ron, is linking wines to place and the context and the history and the foods and all of that, rather than wine simply as what's in your glass. It's the stories behind wine that most interest me, and I know there are a lot of stories that I are waiting to be told from wonderful places in America, in South America, of course, in Australia and New Zealand, in South Africa, and indeed in many other places around the world, many places in Europe that have long histories of wine growing, but which for whatever reason. Their wines are only just being rediscovered now. In Eastern Europe, for example, or the way Greek wines now are, you know, Greece, one of the cradles of, you know, where wine came from, where it spread across the Mediterranean. But Greek wines are really only being discovered and appreciated now. And I know there's some wonderful wines being produced from Greece.
Without question, there is also some other areas over there in the eastern part of Europe that are seems to be rediscovered in places like Georgia and some places like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really somewhere I want to go. I mean, that is where wine was born, really. So, that's so fascinating. And I think they're great drinking traditions and singing traditions with and wine and food traditions that really go back centuries that, you know, it sounds like such a I've tasted a lot of those wines, Ron, and I like them. I like that style. I like the style of the amphora, the Quevebre style wines, and you know the skin contact whites. And
yes.
I think the food from Georgia sounds really good too.
That would be interesting to see, and which leads me also into the newest book. I was reading, you know, Italy in a Wine Glass, and what I find so fascinating about that is. Just talk about wine. You talk about history. You talk about things that do have influence on the grape growing and the winemaking throughout the years. Is all of your books in this style?
No, this is a departure. But it's a book that's really the culmination of more than 30 years of research. I think what I found was when I was traveling in Italy, researching wine, but also I take people on gastronomic cultural tours to Italy. And culture and history are so linked to the Italian way of life today, not just in wine, but, you know, people are very proud and knowledgeable about their particular areas. They know about the art and the artists of the area. They know the history. They know, you know, and they'll talk about it, Ron, as if it was yesterday. But, you know, they're talking about something that happened hundreds of years ago or even thousands of years ago, going back to the Greeks or the Romans or the Etruscans. You know, the Etruscans had a huge wine culture, the Phoenicians as well. And then, you know, through the rise of Christianity and the monastic tradition and, you know, the different dominations of Spanish and the Austrians, all of these, you know, histories are very much part of who Italians are. And so I really wanted to write a book because this, the history of Italy is complicated. You know, many of us love Italy. We travel to Italy often. And, you know, we see these names on the roads, Piazza Garibaldi or Via Vittorio Emanuele II, the first king of Italy, and or Cavour, Via Cavour, the first prime minister. You know, the history is all around us, but it's a complicated history. And I wanted to connect that history through wine because there's such obvious connections through personalities, through events, through movements, through historical eras. So I'm telling the story of Italy from the Greeks to now, to lockdown, to tomorrow even, through wine.
And it's a fascinating book. You said you spent so much time researching this. This is where you get your knowledge of the early Italian of history and makeup and everything is from your research?
Yeah, it's from my travels. You know, I read a lot and, you know, I minored in history. History has always been a real interest. And I don't think you can really explore Italy. And, you know, we love the Renaissance art. We love the food. We love the Roman, you know, remains in Rome, not just in Rome, but, you know, I was in Verona a couple of weeks ago and you walk through the town and there's the big Roman arena where the opera takes place every year now. You know, you just have this past all around you, and, you know, there's a Piazza Dante because Dante, when he went into exile, came up to Verona, and his family are still 21st generation are still in a villa that his son bought after Dante died in the Valpolicella wine mills, and they're still making fabulous wines. So it's those sort of links that, you know, are really so, we're talking about centuries ago, but they seem very much, you know, with us today. And I think that's what you feel in Italy. You feel this past all around you. You want to explore the past. You want to drink the past. And you can drink the past because Italian wine has all these incredible links to, and even if it's more recent, Ron, you know, just the story of cooperatives. You know, Italy is the most cooperative country in the world. 60% of Italian wine is made in cooperative wineries. Well, that's an interesting story in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the history of Italy itself is so fascinating. I think I love the Roman Empire and what they did and all that. And, you know, you hear just the speckling of the fact that they spread grapevines throughout Europe, but it's never publicized much more than that. And your book really brings a lot of this out to, you know, it ties it all together, I think is the best way to put it. And that's
well, they're wines that, you know, have direct links to the past. I mean, two really interesting examples. One of Campania's best known winemakers, of course, is the Mastro Berardino family. It was Antonio Mastro Berardino who, after the war, really helped to revive and safeguard the native grapes of Campania, Alianico, Fiano, and Greco. And his son, Piero, became involved in a fascinating project, and that was to replant a vineyard, or in fact, a number of vineyards, actually within Pompeii itself, discovering where they could tell in the excavations where the actual posts for the vines were in a vineyard that was buried under volcanic ash in AD 79 when Vesuvius erupted and destroyed the city and killed so many people. So just as the voids left from humans or animals so tragically could be filled in with plaster to create the shapes and give us such a poignant, sad and tragic feeling of what happened that day. That can also be done with the vineyard posts, and they could actually see where the vineyards were. Often they were around the amphitheater. And I think it's because Piero Mastro Berardino conjectures that it's because this was wine that was being made to sell in the bars of Pompeii, not one of the Grand Cru wines of the Roman Empire, but wines to quench the thirst of people that were in the amphitheater watching the fights of animals and gladiators and drinking and shouting. And, you know, you can get a sense of that. And that vineyard was actually replanted and wine made from those grapes. So it's an extraordinary link with history that I think is unique.
Yeah, without question, that is unique. That's great. Do you have, and while you were telling that, I had to think, do you have an idea of what the wines were like back then? I mean, you tasted
well,
a lot of Italian wine.
That's a very good question.
I'm sorry?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question because the wines of the past wouldn't have been what the wine from that vineyard was made that I tasted. But there is an example of a wine that comes from the island of Elba. A really, really interesting project. It's called Nesos, and they call it Vino Marino. And it's a wine that a wine producer on the island of Elba set out to create a wine as it had been made by the Romans, a wine that apparently was a favorite of Julius Caesar's. And what he does is he harvests the Ansonica grapes, quite a tough skin grape, makes very full-flavored dry white wines normally. But he had special baskets made, and he put the grapes into these baskets, and then he plunged them underwater into the sea, into the waters of the Tyrrhenian Sea. And I think they stay there for about 10 days.
Mm.
Grapes are quite thick skin, but there's still a little bit of osmosis, still a little bit of absorption of the seawater. And then afterwards, he brings them up, and he lays them out to dry in the direct sunshine, again, for a fairly brief period. And then the grapes are pressed and fermented in small amphora, again, that he had specially made. So it was a project that was a labor of love. He really was just curious to see what wine would result. And it is an extraordinary wine. Only about 300 or 400 bottles are made a year. I've tasted it, and it does feel like you're drinking the past. A little bit oxidized, very, very much a salinity to it, partly, I think, from this period in salt water. But just such a fascinating project. And I think an important point here is that we know about the past and about Italian wines from the past because they're winemakers that are just so curious to make these links. They feel it's part of their patrimony. Piero Mastro Berardino planting that vineyard under the auspices of the archaeological authorities, actually within Pompeii, or Antonio Arrighi making this Vino Marino, this unique wine, tiny quantity, but still such a fascinating project. So that, I think, gives it perhaps an inclination of how wine was. But I think the Roman style was very different. They fermented wines in amphora, as many producers are doing today. And they seemed to like wines that aged for long periods. They would mix wines with other flavorings. They would add seawater sometimes to wines. They would add a number of additives. And so there was an art in mixing wines that, you know, we don't understand in there. So we can't really wholly recreate those flavors of the past. But we can sort of imagine we're drinking the past in some of these wines that are available today.
No, the I remember reading in your book about mixing and adding all sorts of different things to wines. Was that because they were seeking different flavors, or was that because the wine was so acidic and it needed something to balance it out?
I think both. I think you're right. If a wine had some defects, I think they would have tried to correct them, adding chalk or adding various other bits, some of which probably weren't that good for you, to try to correct a wound. But I think also they were curious and wanted different flavors and different styles. So they would have, you know, also experimented and mixed and added spices and honey and different flavors. But it should be remembered, too, that the Romans were the first, and Pliny the Elder was the first to really recognize terroir, and that wines from certain areas had attributes that were unique to that area and linked to grape varieties. And so, you know, we have this, we're all very aware now of provenance and authenticity and terroir in wine, but it was the Romans that really began to define that by, and the wines would have been sold in particularly shaped amphora, which would have been one guarantee of quality, just like bottle shapes today can indicate certain wines.
Yeah, very true. Moving forward away from the Romans in Italy, I was always being curious about how the First and Second World Wars affected vineyards in Italy. I mean, the bombing was devastating to not just cities, but to countrysides and everything else. Did that change the style of grapes, the type of grapes, or did they just replant the same things again?
Well, that's a really, really good question, Ron. And you're absolutely right. The wine country was devastated. The First World War, the wine country, particularly in the Northeast, there was massive fighting. Of course, the Austrians were in this area, and there was massive fighting in what is now Friuli Venezia Giulia, and also in the German-speaking Trentino Alto Adige, so the Sud Tirol, and in the Veneto as well around Asiago. So there was a huge amount of fighting actually in those areas, and vineyards were destroyed. And just beginning to recover when, of course, the Second World War also brought devastation to those areas again, but across the country, right down to the south, across Emilia-Romagna, Piemonte, there was a huge amount of fighting, a civil war fighting between partisans and Italian fascists who remained loyal to Mussolini, and of course the Germans. And then meanwhile, you know, the Allies were bombing the cities and causing destruction. The men were away, and so the vineyards couldn't be harvested or worked. So it was a devastation. And of course, it was a devastation in terms of the economy, because wine and growing grapes was such a vital part of the economy. And it was very important that it could recover. Now, you said, did they simply replant the same? Not always. And I think some areas really thought about after, especially after World War II. For example, Friuli Venezia Giulia. Friuli is a source of some of the most outstanding white wines in Italy, and indeed the world, as well as red wines. Most of the wines are sold, marketed varietally by the single grape variety. And that was a decision that came after the war. And they were very clear that they needed to recover the economy and replant and concentrate on both native grapes as well as international grapes that had been there in some cases for more than 200 years from when Napoleon came across and introduced French grape varieties. So Friuli is a good example of a wine area that really rebuilt itself and reinvented itself as a quality wine region with wines now appreciated around the world.
So the the Italian grape industry survived that. When did they come up with the designations, the DOCs and all the different classes or steps of wine? When was that instigated there?
I think the DOCs were beginning in the 1960s, but interestingly, during the period of fascism under Mussolini, of course, wanted, you know, to celebrate the greatness of Italy, the greatness of everything Italian, including wine. And Mussolini was, and under the fascists, there was a move to protect wines from particular areas, the quality and the genuineness, and to recognize them and celebrate regional wines. So that was a benefit that happened in that period that continued after the war. DOC and DOCG and now IGT, these are the quality designations that, you know, consumers see on the labels. You know, we're still seeing new ones every year, more and more. So it's been an ongoing process, you know, from the 60s on, we've seen more and more DOCs and DOCGs. And I think some of the most interesting wines are IGTs, the Indicazione Geografica Tipica, which gives a little more freedom to the wine producers.
IGT, I don't I'm not familiar with that. Could you expand on that, please?
Yeah, it came really. I guess the equivalent in France would be the vente de paix. So it's, in theory, if you have a quality pyramid, you know, you would have ordinary table wine at the base, and then you might have the IGT, and then the DOC, and the top of the pyramid would be the DOCG in terms of quality. But of course, Italians being Italians, it doesn't quite work that way, because some of the most exciting and some of the most expensive wines are IGTs, wines such as Tignanello. And of course, Ron, you'll remember the whole Super Vini di Tavola, you know, when the Super Tuscans first were created in the 1970s. Because they didn't follow DOC, they were only given the most lowly designation, Vino da Tavola, table wine. But these were some of the greatest wines, and, you know, they astonished the world. I know you were talking about the Judgment of Paris on a recent podcast of yours. Well, this was around that same time, you know, when Marchese Piero Antinori decided that really, you know, the rules, the DOC rules to make Chianti, which insisted upon an inclusion of white grape varieties to make a lighter style of wine, well, that you would never be able to make a great wine doing that. So he threw away the rule book. He planted some Cabernet Sauvignon amongst the Sangiovese vineyards, and the resulting wine was aged in new French oak barrique, the 225-liter new French oak barrels. And, you know, the wine it took the world by a storm. It was amazing because nobody had ever tasted an Italian wine like that. And yet it was only able to be sold as a vino da tavola, a table wine. That was a nonsense. But two things happened as a result of that. Eventually, Tignanello now is an IGT, an Indicazione Geografica Tipica. But the other thing that happened was the producers within Chianti Classico realized that, you know, they needed to change their discipline and rules in order to make great Chianti. And that's happened, and Chianti is now one of the world's, and rightly so, one of the world's great wines. Some of the most exciting wines are Chianti Classicos and other wines from Tuscany that have also adapted as the decades have gone on. But meanwhile, these so-called Super Tuscans or Super Vini da Tavola now often will mainly come under IGTs. So there's a little bit more freedom of expression, and rather than it being a tier below DOC, it might be, but on the other hand, it might be something really fabulous.
Well, it seems to me that using the IGT designation for your wine gives you much more freedom, because as you start getting into the higher tiers, particularly the DOCG, it's so restrictive on what you can do. It's like Chianti, you know, you referred to that. They just expanded it and opened up possibilities on Chianti instead of the strict standards that they had. So the freedom of being able go on.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right, Ron. It has given producers freedom. But on the other hand, a name like Chianti, Chianti Classico, with the, you know, the Gallo Nero, the Black Rooster, which I'm not sure if you can use in the United States. But Chianti Classico now, they realize that this we do have the potential to make some of the greatest wines in Italy and the world. And so they adapted that DOC and that DOCG, and now they're
UGAs coming in, which are communal appellations, and Gran Selezione, which is the top of the pyramid, single vineyard, 100% Sangiovese, from, you know, some of the best producers. So great wines can be made within that discipline, within that DOCG. But then on the other hand, those that choose to make wines outside of that, perhaps introducing, you know, more of a Cabernet Franc or Cabernet Sauvignon than is permitted within Chianti Classico, or making a pure Cabernet Franc in the Chianti vineyards, then they can use the IGT. So you're right, there's more freedom, but also within DOC and DOCG, huge possibilities to make great wine as well.
And it also gives you the what, prestige of having the DOCG designation, I suppose, is getting in the higher ones.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, Chianti is an historic name. For centuries, that name has existed. And that name now rightly has the prestige that it deserves.
And
if
I talk. Go on.
No, no, could you go on?
I've talked about on the show before about the Chianti and Chianti Classico and how the new rules give it more of a standard to live up to than the previous rules. I mean, they were sort of watered down, I think, and they've caught up with the prestige that Chianti Classico has.
Yeah, absolutely. The rules are strict. The wines are outstanding. You don't see them in the bottles with the straw covered, you know, the flask of the flasks.
No.
You know, you would used to see in Trattoria. You don't see that anymore. These are serious wines that, you know, they sell for premium price, deserve to. But, you know, Ron, some of this going back to history comes out of, you know, events that happened in Italy. For example, there was a extraordinary form of agriculture in Tuscany called the mezzadria, and it was a form of sharecropping. And so a landowner would maybe have a number of small holdings, and each family would have a house, it's called a casa colonica, little house, and they would have a patch of land. And on that land, they might grow a few rows of vines, a few rows of olive trees, some vegetables, some fruit. They'd keep a pig and chickens. And mezza means half. And it was, the system was that half of that produce would go to the landowner and half could be kept by the mezzadro, the tenant farmer, the sharecropper. And this began the 1200s, I think. And it was only phased out in the 1970s. So it was so successful, it lasted for 800 years. And it literally shaped the landscape itself. So, you know, there wasn't monoculture because these farms, you know, those small farmers needed to have this mixed, it was called promiscuous agriculture because it was mixed. And, you know, it was only from the 1970s on, there was an exodus from the land when the system ended. The places were abandoned and people moved in, foreigners moved in, they brought new ideas, they were ambitious to not make any old ordinary wine, but to make great wine. They had money. And holiday makers started coming. The English discovered Tuscany, and they called this area Chiantishire. And, you know, it was a transformation of a land, but also it was a transformation of the wine. And, you know, under that old sharecropping system, The goal was to produce as much grapes, as much olives, as much fruit as possible to get the most, not to go for quality. And that quality could only happen under a different system. So history is very linked to the evolution of that wine, Chianti.
Reminds me a lot of Portugal and the port regions and the workers, the little farmlets, and working for the big landlord. Same principle there over the centuries.
Is that right? I didn't know that about, about
Portugal.
But that's fascinating.
It's the same that they had, little small farms that would work for the cooperative and make port through that in different areas and all that. A fascinating story. I'll let you, look into that, pursue that. But I've talked about that.
I wonder, Ron, if that's why.
Go on.
I wonder if that's why now we're seeing so much. So many really exciting new wines coming, table wines, not port, coming from the Douro. There's some fabulous reds as well as whites. And maybe it's because, as you say, those small growers, rather than selling their grapes to the cooperatives, are now making the wines themselves. Is that what you discovered?
Yes. In fact, I had a guest on the show that made a movie about the region over there. And it was really fascinating. He said a lot of areas are getting away from port grapes and are making other types of wines, and some phenomenal wines coming out of the region.
I tasted some.
Oh, yeah, they're wonderful. One thing that he did say, and I was sort of saddened by the thought of it, but he said that the Douro region has been discovered to have a tremendous amount of lithium in the ground. And lithium is, we all know, the main ingredient on the batteries that are being made now all over. And it's a big, big deposit in the ground over there in the Douro region. And he said quite a few people are being concerned about the future of the area and the grape growing because of the lithium. So he just threw that out.
Because it'll be more profitable. Because it'll be more profitable to mine the lithium. Oh, my goodness.
So
that would change that beautiful
that, it's sad to think what might happen. I just hope that it doesn't. But it's sad to think what might happen because of that. So in the Portugal or in the port region. So he mentioned that, and I thought you might be interested in that yourself.
Definitely.
The future of Italian grapes, as is everywhere in the world, we are warming up. Wine regions are getting warmer. Grapes are being stressed. Italy is, in the lower area there. I mean, you're looking at quite a bit of warmth, especially coming around the waters and stuff like that. The waters are not cooling the areas like they used to. What's the future of Italian wines and the Italian grapes?
Well, that's a really good question. And every wine producer I speak to, it's a subject that comes up, Ron.
Oh, yeah.
You can't deny climate change if you drink wine or work in wine, because, we see it in the wines we buy, the way the alcohol levels have got up and up. Wines that used to be 12%, they're 14%, 14.5%. It's very high. And it isn't just the increase in temperatures, 48 degrees in Sicily last summer. Massively hot. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit.
It's about 103, 104.
110.
Yeah.
It's really, really hot. But it isn't just the temperature, Ron. It's the weather patterns that have changed. So, the Alps, much less snow. and snow in an area like Barolo is very important, because those vineyards, snow is good because those chalk vineyards, that allows that moisture to percolate drip by drip slowly through during the winter months and create a reservoir of water for the hotter summer months. But without snow, what's happening now is when it rains, it's rain bombs that come down with such ferocity that the rain just runs off the surface and, you know, it causes huge runoff problems and doesn't have time to soak in. And, you know, rain that hard can damage the vines, it can damage the grapes. Hail is an increasing problem. It's changes in weather patterns as well. And not only that, that heat and that humidity caused huge problems with fungal diseases this year. Massive problems with gray rot and downy mildew. So it's a huge concern. There are ways that are being looked at. I mean, you know, both in the vineyard, there's earlier harvesting, but the problem there is the grapes may be ripe from sugar levels, but they're not yet phenolically ripe, which means you can have green tannins and, you know, they're not complete in that same way. Nonetheless, early harvesting, night harvesting, canopy management to keep the sun off the grapes. Wine growers used to clip the leaves to give the grapes more sun. Now they're doing the opposite. They're keeping the canopy over the grapes to protect them. But also, there's different grape varieties are being experimented with. For example, in Franciacorta, which is where a small area of Lombardy, which produces probably Italy's best bottle fermented sparkling wines from Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, a little bit of Pinot Bianco. It's, you know, we're talking about an area considerably lower than Champagne. Glacial moraine soils, gentle hills, very complex wines, very beautiful sparkling wines. But to keep that freshness and acidity, they've returned to introducing an ancient grape variety that nobody's ever heard of. It's called Herbamat. And Herbamat is resistant to disease. It's late harvesting, it has a tough skin, and it's high in acidity. And a little bit of Herbamat can help to keep the freshness that could be lost in the wines of Franciacorta. Really interesting wines, really worth looking out for. And I think we'll see more of that. There's talk of kiwi varieties, hybrid varieties that are fungal resistant. They're introducing other hybrid varieties that would have been forbidden in European and Italian vineyards previously. And there's talk about something, a very controversial subject, which is gene editing to help grape varieties be more resistant to fungal disease. Not gene modification, gene editing. It's a very significant difference because you're using the same genetic material from the same species, but it's sort of like a clonal selection done in the laboratory. Now, I discuss this in the book. It's a subject I'm uneasy about, but I've spoken to scientists who believe that this can help to control fungal diseases in particular. But it's an area that I think the urgency is there. We can all see how global warming is affecting our lives, whether we're wine growers or not, and it's affecting wine around the world. So I think not just in Italy, but I think producers around the world are looking for solutions and ways to, you know, keep their livelihoods and keep supplying the world with you know, great wine. You know, on the upside, one of the upsides, Rod, I live in Devon, southwest England, but all of southern England and Wales, indeed, you know, we're producing some really good wines now. That didn't happen 20 years ago.
Good champagne.
Have you had any English wines? Yeah. There's, but also still wines, Ron. Really good red wines now, even.
Really? I've heard about the champagnes coming out of England, not the red wines.
Yeah, yeah. The vineyard 3 miles from where I live planted some Pinot Noir to make sparkling wine. It was so hot the summer of 2020, that lockdown summer when none of us could even go out of our houses, that these Pinot Noir grapes over-ripened, and so they made a still red wine. This is Lymston Manor Estate, 3 miles from where I live. And last year in the International Wine Challenge, which is a very important wine competition in London, the Lymston Manor Estate Triassic Pinot Noir 2020 won the Best Red English Wine Award. Astonishing.
Wow.
That's 3 miles from where I live. It's
wow.
a beautiful, light Burgundian-style Pinot Noir.
That sounds exciting. You were mentioned... I'm sorry. You were...
No. It's just that there are upsides to global warming. Not that many, perhaps, but... certainly the rise and rise of English wine and Welsh wine is one positive where I live. On the other hand, you know, we talk about global warming, but we've had the most miserable winter. It's just rained all winter. So, you know, it's not like we're getting wonderful weather all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, global warming actually is a misnomer. I would rather say climate change because that covers
yes,
all
I
of
agree.
That. Yeah,
I agree.
You mentioned,
I think that's right.
Yeah, climate change is a better word. You mentioned genetic modifications. I am an advocate myself for genetic modification. I think, I mean, if you were to do it naturally, and you could do it naturally, it would take years and years and years to come to the same results that a little bit of genetic modification can give you in a matter of months. And we don't have the years and years and years to do it naturally. It's warming up and the climate is changing quicker than we can keep up with it. So I'm an advocate of that. And CRISPR, that's another part of it. CRISPR is a very good way to not change the DNAs or anything. It's you just splicing out and splicing in. And
I think that's what I was talking about, Ron. That must be the term used for what I refer to as gene editing.
Yeah,
where
CRISPR.
You're using the same DNA from the same plant rather than genetic modification, which might introduce a different species or a different plant.
Right.
And you're right. It speeds up what could be done over 20 years into maybe a couple of years. And, you know, it's urgent. We can't.
You just disappeared. If you're there, Mark, you just disappeared. I just lost you.
Shows he's still connected, but there's no audio from
no
him.
Audio. He just stopped for some reason. I still had a couple of questions for him, too. Mark, if you can hear us, then you're still connected, and we still have you online, but we have lost audio. Well, hate it when that happens.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Just for some reason, something happened there. Well, Mark, if you can hear us, and you're still there, so you should be able to hear us. We can't hear you. And so...
Well, that's strange.
There you are.
See if there's anything I can do here.
Oh, there.
Just now you
I can hear you.
Have you, you can hear me.
I can hear
I
you
know
now.
What happened there?
I don't either.
Oh.
You were still online, but you just stopped right in the middle of a word there. So,
oh, my, that's funny. That
Yeah, electronics. What can we say? Another question. You're hearing a lot about biodynamics and organic and all these movements and all, regenerative and all that. But you hear about them, well, since we're living in the States, we hear about them here, obviously. And we hear a lot about them in France. Is that becoming an issue? Is that becoming a fad in Italy, this biodynamic and regenerative and all that? Or do you know? Have you heard?
I would not call it a fad. I would call it a very important element of viticulture in Italy, more
there
so in some areas than in others. But, you know, in, for example, going back to Chianti Classico, this historic heartland producing great wines, 60% of the members of the Consortio of Chianti Classico farm organically.
Wow.
Which is remarkable. You know, if you go back just 20, maybe 30 years ago, virtually nobody was. Badia Cotibono was one of the first early pioneers. And, you know, in those days, if you said you were farming organically, people thought you were crazy. A lot of them don't bother with certification. They don't feel the need. But, yeah, organic farming is very, very important. And you also mentioned biodynamic. Now, biodynamic is, you know, again, if we go back 20 years, Ron, and you'll know this, you know, people thought that, you know, you were crazy if you were farming by the moon and the alignment of planets. And if you were going to bury some cow manure in a cow horn and put it in a cow horn and bury it underground and then dig it up and then make a water it down and make a tea sand that you water the vines with. That's exactly what they do. And you know, people laugh at it, but they're not laughing now because they're big, important names that are using these methods and making the most fabulous wines. So biodynamic, organic, and also just a more sustainable approach to viticulture, to winemaking, are all really vital in the Italian wine world today. Producers are very keen to, when you meet them, the first thing they want to tell you, they don't even tell you about how great their wines are. They tell you how sustainable they are. You know, it's an important part of producers now really do feel the need, even if they aren't organic or biodynamic. But as far as organic and biodynamic, great wines are being produced. I was just judging in Verona in April at a very important wine competition called Five Star Wines and Wines Without Walls. And it's pre-Vinitaly, pre this giant Italian wine festival or fair exhibition. And we judged, there were, I think, 60 judges, and we were judging over 2,000 wines. But I was in this year in the Wines Without Walls section, which is organic, biodynamic, sustainable viticulture.
Mm-hmm.
And we had such a high standard of wines. The wines were just brilliant, and they weren't funky and weird or anything. They were clean. They, if you know, you really wouldn't have told them from apart from conventionally produced wines. So, yes, organic, biodynamic, regenerative, sustainable, very important in Italy, and some really, really good wines being made.
Good. That's good to hear. Mike, do you have any questions or any comments for Mark?
I've got a comment and a question. I was actually in Verona. That's my mother's where she was born and raised. I don't know if I've said this before, but somewhere after first grade, so it was way long time ago. And I remember going to a ski lodge after doing all the you know, visiting and touring type of stuff in Verona. And I think I said this before on the show, but so I'm like after first grade, so I'm very young, sitting in the ski lodge. There's long benches there, and everybody ate next to each other. It wasn't a big thing. But what struck me was when they came around and every two people got their own bottle of wine, no matter how old you were. And I'm looking at my mom. I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this? And they go, that's for you and your brother. Drink it. And I was like, we're not talking a sip. It was a full, I don't know, 750. Whatever it was, you know, I'm thinking, this is going to be a good ski session here.
What a great country. So,
yeah. And that was like, you know, we went to the Colosseum. We went to see, Shakespeare, Juliet's balcony and all that. You know, we did all that stuff and went to Venice. But that, I think, was the biggest, you know, besides all the architecture, because I'm a kid, I'm thinking, okay, whatever. But to have my brother and I, our own bottle of wine at, you know, 7, 8 years old was just.
Well, I love that.
It was
Mike,
fantastic.
Is that what did that instill a love of wine with you, Mike?
It may seem difficult the first round, but it was
right.
I think it did, but I didn't appreciate it until later in life because it was kind of like a one off type thing. Like, you know, we didn't do that here, you know, so. I guess I didn't really catch on to it until, you know, later as an adult,
Sure.
Now. But the question, you're a certified wine ambassador, and I don't recall if this was answered, so I apologize if it was, but what was the process to become certified as an ambassador? Is it a formal course of study? Is it online? Is there testing involved? What did you have to do?
Yeah, it's a very rigorous study period involving online lectures and tasting in person in Verona, or it's now actually done in New York as well. I think it's done in Hong Kong. A few other places around the world through the Viniti and the International Academy. And then there's a fiendishly difficult exam. I think the pass rate is about 25%, which is both a multiple choice and a practical tasting exam. So it's a very, and students have to make a video to show they can present and talk about Italian wine. So it's really trying to make a cohort of ambassadors who deeply understand Italian wine and can communicate and, you know, tell the story of Italian wine wherever they are in the world. And the Italian wine ambassadors are located all around the world. So there are a number in the U.S., I think the largest number in the U.S., but in virtually every country.
Hmm.
So it's, if anybody, any listeners are very, you know, passionate about Italian wine, probably working in wine and want to find out more, it's the Vinitaly International Academy.
Huh. Interesting. Quite a bit involved with it there.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Okay, thank you. That was it.
Italy in a Wine Glass, the story of Italy through its wines. I can't say I read all of it. I didn't have the time to read all of it. It's a long 340 some odd pages, but it is fascinating. I enjoyed reading. I particularly enjoyed reading the history. There was so much history. I mean, it's you can tell that you did spend time looking through the background of the areas that you were talking about, and it just absolutely fascinating. And it won't be out in hardbound until this month sometime. Is that correct?
It's the 28th of May, Ron.
Oh.
28th of May is a U.S.-Canada publication date. Came out here in England last month, but it's the 28th of May.
So it will be now. It'll be available by the end of the month. Is that going to be available on Amazon and all the outlets online and everything, or do we have to get it directly from publisher or from you or something?
No, absolutely. It can be, I think you can pre-order it now on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, on any, or indeed from any independent bookseller. The publisher is Melville House in New York.
Oh, is it? Okay. And that also, we cannot skip talking about the fact that your other 14 books are also available too. So if anyone is interested in any of the others, then they are all out there. You did not use a nom de plume, did you? Everything is under Mark Millen?
No. Mark Millen or Mark M. Kim Millen, my wife, who is a photographer. A lot of those books are sadly out of print, but available through various outlets, and they are still out. They are still out there and can be found, but maybe in secondhand copies or various other ways that books find their way around the world.
They do.
We're going back to books that were published 40 years ago.
Oh, wow. Is Italy in the Wine Glass in just English, or is it published in other languages?
Well, I hope it'll be. I'm really hoping I can find an Italian publisher for it. But so far, I think a few foreign rights editions have been sold. I haven't had the latest from my agent, but I know they're hoping to sell foreign rights.
Fantastic.
As much
Fantastic.
As possible.
Any last comments or anything, Mark, before we say good evening to you?
Well, I'd just like to say it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Ron. It's been really nice to have this easy conversation. I'm sorry about the technical glitches.
It happens.
Not quite sure.
It's been
a real pleasure.
We've had our share of technical glitches over the years, so we are used to it. Mark, it was really a pleasure. You are, without a doubt, very knowledgeable and interesting. And the latest book is something that everyone, if they are a wine enthusiast of any type, even just an amateur, the history that you include in the book is well worth reading itself. Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for taking the time to join us. And the next book you write about Portugal and the wines there, come back on the show and we'll talk about that.
I'd love to. I love Portugal and I love Portuguese wines. So who knows?
Yeah.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Have yourself
a
good evening.
Have a good evening. Okay. All the best to you both. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Thank you. Okay.
Very good.
All right. It's just the book is fascinating. They sent it to me online. Whatever you call it, I can't think of the word, but I've been reading it, and the history is just fascinating. The format of the book is different than it doesn't just talk about wine. It talks about the history of the area and stuff like that. It'll go through an area and talk about an area, and then it'll say the wines of the area, and he'll talk about the wines of the area. And it just is so interesting. I really have enjoyed reading through it and finding out the information on it. Let's see, find an index here. Oops, I went too far. Find an index that can give you some of the topics of the book. And let's see, there we go. Contents. Ooh, boy, this thing jumps. There we go. Tower power, unification, nation building through the stomach, heroic wines, wars and wine, just different topics, but it doesn't just talk about the wines. It gives you the history, the triumph of Christianity. I highly recommend it. Anyone out there who has any type of desire to know more about Italian history and Italian wines. I'll talk for a few minutes. I'll be right back with you.
All right. So the show will be, this show that you're listening to right now will be repeated on Thursday. We'll put it on Flatline Radio. You can listen to it anytime on Blog Talk Radio and on social media. So it's available there all the time. And then it'll probably be repeated on Saturday as well. So next Saturday. So at the usual time. And we'll welcome Ron back to the program for after that little break.
Yeah, a very good friend of mine passed away a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago. And they are having the celebration of life for him today. And that was his wife calling and asking me if I was going to be coming. Yeah. So I just, mm-hmm. That's why I wanted to answer it. Otherwise, I would have ignored it. But I just didn't want to tell her.
Basically, I just told them that this will be repeated on Thursday. Probably won't do it on Blog Talk Radio or social media because it's there now. On our live feed, definitely we'll do it there. And then, of course, it'll be on Spotify. Yay, we're on Spotify.
Yay, Spotify.
That was easy enough. I don't know if they do live shows. I think they only do recorded. I'll have to look into that possibility.
All right.
I don't think they do live, but I'll check into that just in case. So we can feed there as well. I don't know. I know there's a few that do, but because Blog Talk Radio is kind of iffy right now.
Yeah. Went through that. Refer to April, and you can get an idea.
Yes.
You know.
We
lost two interviews. Well, we postponed two interviews that we had scheduled. So.
Yeah. So tune into this show next Thursday, which will be May the something. Gosh, what is it?
Ninth, I believe.
Yeah, the 9th. Today's so
9th is this coming
day.
Thursday. And then the 16th, after that, we have a guest.
Mm-hmm. Alfie, Deer Nail Grapes. So he'll be on the 16th.
Exactly. Next couple of weeks.
Good
and then hopefully we'll start getting some of these ones that we have lost because of my illness and because of Blog Talk Radio. We'll get those rescheduled and we'll start getting those done.
Yeah.
So thanks again, Mark. Yeah. It was a wonderful talking with you. And thank you all for listening. Be safe.
Yeah. Happy rest of the Sunday, and we'll talk to y'all next week. you'll hear this next week. Not,
yeah.
We'll talk in 2 hours. Okay. Cool. Have a good one. Thanks again.
Thank you. Be safe.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About
Wine
with your host, Ryan. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com.
And on Spotify.
/All About Wine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
All About Wine. You need to make a new closing.
I think so. I probably heard about that one. All right. We are off of there.
We're out of here. Going to the green room. Goodbye, everyone.
People. Yep. I think.